is risk to the general media. And today's topic is kind of a mix of the two, as he'll be speaking on the Mideast and the Mideast in turmoil, but presenting what he calls an optimist perspective on the future. So without any further ado, I present you with Rabbi Jonathan Rosenblum.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Mencken. I have a little bit of bad news to start the speech with half an hour ago as I reached into my notes to pull out the carefully constructed speech that I had prepared. I discovered that the notes were nowhere to be found. Inasmuch as I was also a half an hour away from my destination to give this speech, I had little choice but to go on. On the good side, I'm hopeful that since I gave the speech, some variant of the speech within the last 10 days, that I'll be able to make do without those notes. On the other hand, last night, I was discussing a shidduch with a certain rab who specializes in graphology, and he looked at my handwriting, and he looked at my son's handwriting, and he said, "Your son has a much better memory than you do." Fortunately, however, he said, "Your son has a very good memory." So let's hope that my less than very good memory will still be adequate to the task at hand. And in any event, since I call this speech in my own mind, when there's no more hope, an optimist view, so I'm going to be optimistic about it. Clearly, the situation in Israel today, from many points of view, is not an easy one. It's not an easy one for those of us who live here, for those of us who are raising large families, for anybody, for that matter, who is in Israel. I think that the general mood in some ways goes back to the war this summer in Lebanon, which, of course, from the internal Israeli perspective, was very, very difficult. It was difficult in the sense that the major institutions of Israeli society, first of all, the government proved itself to be incapable of developing a particular plan or sticking to a plan that made any particular sense. At the end of the war, the most serious charge ever leveled, in my opinion, ever leveled at an Israeli head of state was leveled at the prime minister, and by no less an authority than the recently retired chief of staff, former chief of staff, Moshe Bugi Yaalon, who said that the last 2 days of the war constituted the last 2 days of this war in which Israel embarked upon a major land operation after having failed to do so for the preceding 29 days, and which was undertaken at a time when the UN was already sitting on a ceasefire resolution, and it was clear that such a resolution would soon go into effect, that operation constituted basically a spin operation. A spin operation which, on the other hand, over 30 Israeli soldiers were killed. Over almost a quarter of the total casualties of the war, the military casualties of the war, were suffered in those last 2 days. That was a very damning criticism of the functioning of the political echelon. The military level, we've had a host of military investigations of performance of the war, culminating last week in the chief of staff, Dan Haluz's announcement that he was going to resign as the chief of staff, something I believe has not happened in Israel since the 1973 war, when the chief of staff at that time also resigned before the termination of his term. But that, again, is a recognition that the repeated reports that come back in repeated internal army reports and the anticipated Winograd Commission report on the war, that these were going to be very negative with respect to the chief of staff, and those that have been issued so far already have been, in terms of the ability of the command to get its orders to the troops in the field, to develop a coherent strategy for ground commanders to know what was going on, and to deal even at the level, if they were sitting back in their bunkers trying to observe the war at a remove behind the current high technology, their inability to do so and to take the initiative as Israeli armies have always been famous for it in the past. So there's been a great deal of criticism even of the military echelon, which probably remains the most respected aspect, the most respected institution in Israeli society. So that's one aspect, and that's been hanging over us since the summer. It's reflected perhaps in the fact that the Prime Minister today, when asked, when voters are asked how many feel that he's doing a very good job, he's hovering way below President Bush. His figure for that for doing a very good job, is now at 1%. The defense minister is not doing well. Actually, 85% of the country say that they hope that he'll resign speedily from his current task as defense minister. So there is not a great deal of hope and a great deal of faith in the current political leadership in the country. On the other hand, that political leadership, perhaps because of its very weakness, is holding on to each other desperately. The coalition appears rather stable, more stable than most Israeli coalitions, probably because of the weakness of each one of its component parts. And there is no real move towards new elections or replacing that government anytime in the near future. It might well serve out its term. That in itself reflects the fact that for all the antipathy directed at the current political leadership, there's nobody who really sees some white horse, a man on a white horse who's going to come and rescue Israel. The two most often spoken about successors to the current prime minister are both former failed prime ministers, both of whom were issued out of office with resounding defeats, Netanyahu in 1999, and Ehud Barak, his successor, who defeated him in 1999, a year and a half later, who basically was defeated in the largest landslide in Israeli history. So that reflects that there is no savior right on the immediate horizon. In addition to that, we have the ongoing conflict with the Palestinians and a recognition that that conflict is not going to end anytime in the near future. It's not going to end anytime in the lifetime, in my opinion, not anytime in the lifetime of those the adults among us, and it's hard to see how it will end in our children's lifetime as well, for a few very simple reasons. Since the Oslo process commenced in the beginning of the 90s, the Palestinian Authority used its media and its textbooks and its educational system to whip the population into a frenzy of which they concluded that the greatest mitzvah, the greatest deed that they can do, the aspiration for a lifetime, is to kill as many Jews as possible, even at the expense of one's own life. That frenzy will not soon abate, certainly not with the continued Israeli strategy of never quite defeating the Palestinian enemy or not really taking the battle to our terrorist attackers, but trying to reach some kind of low-intensity warfare where they shoot missiles, our cities come under fire, 75% of the population, or the children, they wrote, are suffering from post-traumatic syndrome because of the regularity in which they're hit by missiles. Missiles which may be small, may be pinpricks in the eyes of the New York Times, but are highly lethal if they happen to fall on you, and they have done, as they have done to at least 15 citizens of Sderot so far. In another way, if we look at the, as long as it's clear that the Palestinians have not made any strategic decision, I mean the general population has made no strategic decision to opt for peace, to build up its own state or its own political entity, rather than to focus on the destruction of the Jewish state, then there's also not going to be peace. And despite having been the largest beneficiary of international aid in the last two decades, the per capita aid that has flowed into the Palestinian Authority has been absolutely immense on a per capita basis. And yet that money has been consistently turned towards the purchase of more weapons and maintaining 12 or 13 various security forces, each one of which, when it's not firing at one another, is potentially going to be firing at Israel. So maintaining 50,000 men under arms and using whatever funds are now funneled to the Palestinian Authority via the European Union to maintaining those security services, to keep men under arms, rather than developing any viable economy, rather than building up taking down its refugee camps and building decent housing in its place. I think the example, that the metaphor for this that really captures that failure on the part of the Palestinians to decide to focus on building up their own economic life, their own, and bettering their own future rather than destroying that of Israel's Jews, is their destruction, their rampaging through the hothouses which were purchased for their benefit after the Gaza withdrawal at the cost of $13 million by a group of American Jewish philanthropists, and instead of turning those into productive agricultural agricultural economy as they were when they were held by the Gaza farmers, by the Jewish farmers of Gaza. They simply were stripped bare and ceased to become terribly productive. That reflects the failure on the part of the Palestinians to focus on their own future. In their own narrative, in their own insistence, there is no Palestinian leader. We hear a lot, especially when Condoleezza Rice is in the neighborhood, about building up Abu Mazen, who's viewed as a moderate voice. There has never been one word from Abu Mazen where he has even as a peep or a hint that there might be any concession on the issue of Palestinian refugees returning to Israel proper, to returning to within any borders for Israel. The Palestinians, to a man, continue to insist on the absolute right of return for any Palestinian refugee, and not just the refugees from 1948, but all of their descendants and their descendants' descendants till the end of time. There's no other group of refugees from that period of 1948 that wasn't resettled in someplace else, including 600,000 Jewish refugees from Arab countries who wasn't resettled and is no longer claiming any right or any intention to go back to where it originally came from. Of all the 12 million refugees in the world since 1948, only the Palestinians continue to insist on their right to return to their original homeland, and only the Palestinians are defined as refugees by virtue of descent from those who left in 1948. As long as that continues to be a centerpiece of the Palestinian narrative, again, the possibilities of peace with the Palestinians are minute. Then there is our own internal problems, the problem of corruption, which has beset the Israeli government to a rather remarkable degree. Right now we have a president who's under investigation for sexual harassment charges, a justice minister on trial for the same charges, a prime minister who's under investigation on any number of charges, the fourth Israeli prime minister in succession, by the way, to have come under criminal investigation and have to answer in police investigation. You have the head of the anti-corruption forces in the Civil Service Commission, also under investigation. The chief police commissioner, also under suspicion arising out of another affair. The head of the former justice minister and the head of the Knesset, the same person, the head of the Knesset Foreign Defense and Defense and Foreign Affairs Committee, also under criminal indictment. You begin to get a sense that the rot has spread very far, that there's something about our political echelons and this at a time when Israel faces the kind of threats that it does, when you have political echelons who either put their own private interests or are unable to restrain themselves with respect to their own private interests, who use political power to carry on shady real estate deals, to help friends and bank tenders and so forth. That's one problem. So that a person who's always involved in his own individual personal affairs is certainly not going to be able to concentrate his full energies on the crucial issues facing the country. And then you have the others who may have many good ideas, Justice Minister Ramon, or the one who's under trial right now, but who seem incapable of restraining themselves even momentarily from the most fleeting pleasures that might come their way. Also not a good recommendation for being able to give the real deep thought that needs to be given in order to address the situation that Israel faces today. The Chazon Ish, somebody once came to the Chazon Ish, the great leader of the Torah Judaism after the Holocaust in Israel, and they said about a certain person that this person was a fine person, a tremendous Talmid Chacham, a great scholar, a Baal Chesed, he was generous, he had all the virtues except for one thing. When it came to his own personal interests, he lost all perspective, he couldn't control himself. And the Chazon Ish said that the person who was recommending this fellow for a particular job, he said, the failure to control oneself, the failure to be able to put aside one's own personal interest, is not a single flaw. It's a pervasive flaw. It pervades everything that a person does. A person who cannot put aside his personal interest, when he prays, when he davens, he'll pray with that self-interest. When he learns Torah, he learns with his own self-interest. When he gives tzedakah he gives with his own self-interest. It pervades everything he does. He cannot be called a great man. A person can fail in any number of ways. And even the greatest of men do fail in particular instances, without diminishing his status as a great man. But a person who can't control himself when it comes to his self-interest, whose self-interests are always ruling over him, then that person cannot be described as a great man. We're seeing over again the corruption, these repeated corruption scandals, which have become endemic at this point, are so much, they reflect again a political leadership which is always placing its personal interests first. This isn't the only area in which this happens. I think when I was growing up in America, we always had a saying, don't toot your own horn. If you were on the playground, it was never advisable to say, I'm the fastest runner here, I'm the best baseball player, I'm the smartest kid in class. People who did so were regularly frowned upon. In Israel, whenever a vacancy arises in any position, any ministry comes open, there are usually half a dozen candidates who convene press conferences to announce themselves to be the best qualified candidate for the position, however unremarkable their records of public service are up until that point. One of our politicians, I think, has now carried on about 6 press conferences to announce himself the best qualified for every position up to and including being the prime minister. So that sense of oneself, the ego that takes over, if we don't develop a generation of leaders who are able to put aside their own personal interests and focus on the crucial problems facing the country. Now, among these problems, and perhaps the most overwhelming of all of them, is the threat from Iran. The Iranian threat, the threat of a nuclear Iran, I can commend to you, there was a piece by Benny Morris on Friday's Jerusalem Post, which really put it as glumly as anybody could possibly put it, which is sort of interesting because Benny Morris is known as the father of the new... I commend any of you who haven't read that piece until now to do so. He's known as the father of the new historians in Israel. He was one of the major forces behind transferring the old Zionist narrative and taking a much more pro-Palestinian... substituting a much more pro-Palestinian narrative in its place. The fact that he's come to the political positions that he has today is a reflection of how disillusioned the general Israeli population has become with the whole peace process and the whole hopes, how scant are the hopes that were so prevalent, that were roused to an almost messianic pitch by the original Oslo Accords in 1991, and how far we have come from that. But the Iranian problem, as Ephraim Sneh, who was the son of the former leader of the Israeli Communist Party, he is currently the deputy defense minister, but I'm just pointing out that he comes from the left wing of the political spectrum, not from the right wing. And he describes the Iranian threat as follows. The danger is not so much that Ahmadinejad decided to launch an attack, but Israel is living under a dark cloud of fear from a leader committed to its destruction. I'm afraid that under such a threat, most Israelis would prefer not to live here. Most Jews would prefer not to come here with their families, and the Israelis who can live abroad will. I'm afraid Ahmadinejad will be able to just kill the Zionist dream without pushing a button. That is not a hysterical conclusion. The Shalem Center last week came out with a new study on emigration patterns. In 2002, 0.9% of Israeli researchers and academics emigrated. That number had jumped to 1.7 by 2004, almost doubling. Of those who have left the country, of academics, researchers, who have left the country since 1996, 95% of them have remained abroad and not returned. Those kinds of trends would only be exacerbated and made worse by an actual nuclear Iran. And were Israel, now they're basically 2 responses to that. I mean, we could pray for regime change in Iran, and that might conceivably happen under the right set of circumstances, and with enough pressure exerted on the current regime there, enough anger generated by the economic mess that they made of the country, by their ethnic divisions in the country, and by the absolute oppression which they have inflicted upon the population. So there are reasons to think that in the long run that might happen. But in the short run, that's not likely to happen, which leaves only 2 alternatives. Either America will act to take out the Iranian missiles, or Israel will have to do so. Those aren't the same choices. Those are not equal alternatives. If America doesn't do it, America has many, there are many reasons why. For those of us in Israel and those of Jews, and I think citizens of the West everywhere, should vastly prefer the American alternative, even though it is hard to imagine any American president other than our current president, any possible successor, doing so if he has not acted by the time he leaves office. And you should remember, I met with a group of, or I didn't meet, a friend of mine, a notable lady from the New Republic, met with a group of American congressional aides several weeks ago, and they told him almost to a man, both Republicans and Democrats, that if Bush would attack the Iranian nuclear installation, that he would certainly, there would be impeachment articles introduced in Congress and almost certainly be brought about. So basically, right now, we depend very much on the determination of one man, I mean, maybe anathema to most of American Jewry, not too popular with most Americans in any stripe at this particular time, but it's only his determination that really offers us much hope that America will act. And why do I say it makes such a big difference whether Israel or America acts? If America acts, then the American economy is too powerful. America is too central to the whole entire world economic system and the world. It's the most powerful country in the world. It cannot be made a pariah state, no matter what it does by the rest of the world. That's certainly not the case for Israel. If oil prices shot up $40 a barrel in response to an attack on Iranian nuclear plants, and as a consequence, oil shot up and the world economy went tanked, Israel would be blamed, even for those European countries, and they would be, most of them, which would breathe a sigh of relief if it was successful, on the assumption that it was successful, even those European countries who might breathe a sigh of relief to see Iranian nuclear capacity set back by many years would nevertheless see it also, at the same time, simultaneously, as an opportunity to declare Israel a pariah state, which it already is in the eyes of a large strata of European policymakers. And remember that it was just precisely the desire not to be declared a pariah state that led Ariel Sharon, probably just before his stroke, to bring about the Gaza withdrawal. It was a desire to avoid and win a more favorable climate of world opinion on Israel's behalf, which was probably the moving force behind that particular withdrawal from Gaza. So that's one very big difference from Israel's point of view, who does it. Secondly, it's a mistake to think of the attack on Iran as a purely, if it were to be successful, as a purely dependent upon air power. Now, obviously, America could bring to bear more air power than Israel could as well. Israel would be fighting on a number of fronts simultaneously. Any attack on Iran, probably even an American attack, will bring a heavy missile barrage from Iran. It will bring missiles coming down from Hezbollah in the north. It will likely, possibly and even likely, bring the Syrians to try out their missiles and send them in our direction. So Israeli forces would be fighting on many fronts at once, and the Air Force would be deployed in many areas. But the most important reason why America has more wherewithal to do this is simply this. America, the most effective attack on Iran is not limited to air power. It would involve America's massive naval power as well. The ability, most people talk about an attack on Iran and why it would be so bad because the Straits of Hormuz would be closed off and the world's oil supply would be cut. But that cuts two ways. Remember that Iran is a net importer of oil products, which means that after two or three days, after weeks and maybe even a much shorter period of time, if the Straits of Hormuz were closed, then Iran would run out of petroleum product. Its army would be simply non-functional. The country would draw to a standstill as there was no more gas or oil to be had to fuel its vehicles. That would allow the American, operating off of its naval power in the Gulf, take out the many of the Iranian missile launching sites on the Gulf, to take over the oil tank, the Iranian oil rigs along the entire Gulf, about 100 of them. If this seems far-fetched, it's a scenario that's presented by somebody named Arthur Herman in the November issue of Commentary. If it seems far-fetched, you should know that America did it before. It was done in 1987, and it was one of the major steps that brought about the end of the Iraq-Iran war. So it had been done before, but America could do it. Israel doesn't have anything like the naval power or the ability to do anything like this. It would make the subsequent air attack, these things would all be done before there was any air attack on the nuclear facility. It would make the subsequent air attack that much more effective, and it would give them give America a tremendous bargaining power as long as it was holding on to Iranian oil facilities for regime change in Iran, something that's not going to be brought about, obviously, by any Israeli attack, no matter what fashion it takes place. Another good reason why it makes a big difference whether it's America or Israel. But I'm just pointing out that the Iranian situation is itself the major cloud hanging over most Israelis if we would even allow ourselves to think about the real threat and all of its implications. I think that's something that most of us don't want to do, and so we don't do it. Now, what does this mean? What does it mean for Israel that there are so many things that might cause people to lose hope? You have to understand that this is not a new phenomenon here. If anybody who's lived in Israel since 1948 has never lived in a period in which we could say with any degree of certainty, we've achieved peace. Peace has now been achieved, and we can look forward to the future, a peaceful future. We have succeeded in securing our borders, defeating our enemies, making it unlikely that they'll ever attack us again. There was one brief interlude in which Israelis thought like that. That was after the 1967 war, but by 1970 we were again engaged in a very destructive and costly war of attrition with Egypt along the Suez Canal, and by 1973 we had the Yom Kippur War, in which the highest number of Israeli casualties since the War of Independence were suffered. So that turned out to be illusory. There was no real peace, even when we thought that we had attained that peace. No one believes that we've attained that peace today. And that means that if you don't have a very good reason for being here, if you don't have a clear idea of what it is, why it's important that the Jewish people exist, why it's important that what mission could we fulfill as a people in this land, why is it important that we should have a state or that we should be in Eretz Israel, and what is the continued survival of the Jewish people about, then it becomes harder and harder to sustain the desire to live there, especially for those who have the talents and the wherewithal to leave. And that obviously involves a large number of Israelis. We're talking about a country, and on the good side, powerful economy, the second or third highest number of high-tech patents of any country in the world. A country which has achieved remarkable things in the economic sphere and the scientific spheres. There are plenty of Israelis for whose services there is a big demand around the world. Now, if there is no long-range perspective in which we come to peace, then the impetus to leave simply grows that much stronger. That, incidentally, has been one of the considerations that I believe, and I think there's a lot of evidence for this, which has influenced the Israeli government since the outset of the Oslo Accords. Yitzhak Rabin, I don't think, entertained a lot of illusions about Palestinian intentions or the possibility of long-range peace with the Palestinians. At the same time, he was concerned about a loss of national will in the face, something had to be done, something dramatic had to be done to recreate a sense of hope among the Israeli population. And that was the outset of Oslo. Before Ehud Barak went to Camp David, where he basically offered Palestinians, made an offer which was way beyond the consensus in Israel, way, way beyond any place where the Israeli political consensus had ever reached up until that time, including virtual sovereignty over East Jerusalem, virtual sovereignty over the Temple Mount, 95% and later up to 98% of the West Bank. before he went there, he gave a speech on Yom Kippur, and the memorial for the fallen in the Yom Kippur War, where he talked about the fact that the Israeli spirit was not what it once was. And so you could see this idea that was playing in his mind, that a certain sense of optimism had been lost. Before Sharon embarked on the Gaza withdrawal, he talked about the fact, in a speech to American Jewish businessmen, he talked about the fact that people always have to have hope. Never underestimate the power of hope. That the Gaza withdrawal, above all else, was an attempt to make such a dramatic break, to do something dramatic which would infuse the population again with a sense of hope that something dramatic might be done, that this concept of unilateral withdrawal, drawing our boundaries, our borders, to our taste, could in effect secure our safety, our relative safety, for a long period of time. Now that turned out to be an illusion, just as the withdrawal from Lebanon, which was hailed as Barak's biggest success during his time as Prime Minister and for 6 years subsequent to that, turned out to be an illusion last summer. But that was, a major impetus to preserve the sense of hope. You see the same thing in a speech given by Olmert, Prime Minister Olmert, before he became Prime Minister, to a group of American businessmen, when he said, "We're tired of winning. We're tired of being strong. We're tired of fighting." And he ran on a platform that Israel should become a fun place to live. Let's stop talking about ourselves as a Sparta, as a besieged society. Let's talk about Israel as a fun society, reflected in the new ad campaign for the tourism ministry to advertise the virtues of Israeli beauties in Eilat rather than any connection to our historic ties of land as a reason why people should come and visit Israel. So behind all of this goes a certain thread. You have to maintain some sense of hope among the population. And that is certainly true. If the Jewish people weren't the most hopeful of people, if we had not held on, we could never have held on as we have throughout our entire history. If we had not had a faith in a future that would be better than the present in many cases, we could not have held on. Hope is a very important ingredient in every people. But in some, the illusory hopes that cannot possibly be realized, hopes that have no basis in reality, it's one thing to be optimistic. It's even possible to be a Cubs fan, as I am, but it is impossible to sustain absolutely hopes that go against all rational predictions for too long. And I think that when I said at the outset that in some sense there's a certain optimism, there's a flip side to everything that I've been describing. The flip side is threefold. One is that we have gained a great deal of clarity. Is that it is now widely understood across the Israeli political spectrum, seemingly not by our current foreign minister, that we cannot achieve peace. It is not within our power to achieve peace. No matter how much we may will it, we cannot force the Palestinians to accept our presence here. We cannot, until they are more concerned with their future, we cannot make peace happen. It is not within our power. And therefore, further concessions to bolster this Palestinian leader or another, each one of whom has still refused to even hint, and probably in order not to be assassinated, as incapable or unwilling, whichever, it doesn't really matter, unwilling to hint at any renunciation of the right of return, which is, as everyone knows, a call for the destruction of the state of Israel, simply to flood it with so many Arabs that it ceases to become anything like a majority Jewish state. That there has been no hint of any flexibility on this point in the entire history of Palestinian affairs from 1948 to the present. Whereas Israeli public opinion has gone under great shifts. I remember the Peace Now positions when I was a law student in 1976. The Peace Now positions of 1976 were the Likud positions by 1994. When it had been the far left of the Israeli political consensus and beyond the consensus had become not only the mainstream but been accepted by the right wing of America, of the Israeli political mainstream by 1994, and even up until the last elections when Kadima, running basically mostly made up of former right-wingers, was running on a platform of convergence and withdrawal from most of the West Bank as the most viable solution for Israel's long-range problems. Hope is a necessary and a good thing, but hope that's illusory and only leads you into making your situation more dangerous is not a good thing. To the extent that we have gained clarity, then some of the situation that besets us now, particularly vis-a-vis the Palestinians, is to our good. There is also, and here I speak not as a political analyst, I'll put on my other hat, or my blacker hat, or at least my black kippah. There's another aspect of this. That aspect is. It's really hinted at in Parshas Hazinu. In Parshas Hazinu, the very end of the Torah, when Moshe Rabbeinu is this song that Moshe Rabbeinu is predicting the future that will come about to Klal Yisrael. And he's speaking in the name of God, as it were, in the voice of God, says, "You provoked me with a non-nation. You provoked me with non-gods. And I will provoke you with a non-nation." Non-gods, not false gods, but non-gods. Things which had no pretense of Kedusha, had no pretense of holiness. Material plenty, a good life, a fun society, regular, let's become another post-industrial hedonistic society on the European model. You provoked me with that, and I provoked you with a non-nation. A non-nation? The Palestinians, the people who had no national identity, who have gained their national identity only in the very recent decades, who never thought of themselves as anything other than southern Syrians, who were never seen in the world as anything other than part of the larger Arab nomadic tribes from the region, not as a separate entity with a separate national identity. But as our national identity wanes, so theirs waxed, so theirs grew stronger. And today, they have, to some limited extent, a national identity. I mean, the current civil war, or potential civil war in Gaza, breaking up in clan fighting and fighting between Hamas and Fatah, suggests it's a limited national identity, but there is definitely a national identity. I will provoke you as a non-nation. And there, the pasuk goes on. Moshe Rabbeinu continues that only when the Jewish people see, to quote, "their power is gone with nothing left to keep or abandon, will God save us." The Gemara in Sanhedrin says that refers to the time when we give up all hope of redemption, we give up all hope of Mashiach, we give up all hope of redemption. Only then will Israel be redeemed. Now, how can this be understood? How can we understand such a concept? How are we ever going to understand? The redemption is one of the 13 principles of faith, which we, if anybody stays in davening that long any morning, you can recite in davening every day. The belief in the coming of Mashiach, the coming of the redemption, is one of our basic principles of faith. So to say that only when that is lost will the redemption come, it doesn't make any sense. So Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky explains, this refers to the time when we lose all belief in any redemption through the natural processes, that the nations of the world will take pity upon us, the nations of the world will suddenly be filled with such love of us that they'll grant us peace, that they'll grant us an ability to live in our own land, well, they'll grant us the ability to live, rather than what we see today, where the world is basically, certainly Europe has declared Israel a mistake and is even prepared to view the eradication of that mistake, or to stand by while that eradication or the threat to it goes forward. They see that clearly in the almost supine position that Europe has adopted vis-a-vis Iran after 3 years of being jerked around by the Iranian negotiators. They come up with the most feeble sanctions against Iran. There's no intention in Europe, no willingness in Europe to protect not just the Jewish state, but to protect themselves against a nuclear-armed Iran dedicated to spreading Islam Islamism throughout the world and sitting in a sport, strait in which, through which 40% of the world's oil supply passes, coming into possession of nuclear weapons. Israel, Europe simply doesn't have the will for it, and it's willing to let Israel pay the price for its lack of will. Certainly no will will be expended. If it won't be expended at their own self-defense, it certainly won't be expended at the defense of Israel. So Rabbi Yaakov says, only when we give up all hope that somehow the redemption is going to come through the natural historical process, only when we recognize that ultimately there is no hope other than in God, can that redemption come about. We basically have to be in the situation that the Jewish people confronted at Yom Suf. The sea in front of us, the Egyptians behind us, no place to look besides to turn upward, turn towards the Kodesh Baruch Hu, and to go forward. Because besides that, there really is no, there's nothing that we can look forward to as taking us out of this present morass. I mean, there's a lot of things that we have to do. That doesn't mean that we abandon all political action, all defensive action. Excuse me for a second. It's a reminder that I'm missing my kavusa. That only when that happens can we look forward to redemption. A third positive development, in my mind, is, and this started, it was most evident during the Lebanese War, is a re-examination on the part of Israelis of themselves. When Israelis complain about their political leaders today, they don't simply talk about, our leaders are rotten, but we're good. Everything is fine here, but we just have these rotten leaders. There's a widespread perception that we basically have the political leadership that we deserve, that something has gone wrong here with us, that something has gone wrong internally, that we have lost something. Interestingly, the most fervent exponent of this view during the Lebanon War was a writer in Haaretz, the far-left paper in Israel, Ari Shavit, who expressed this more over and over again. He talked about the fact that we looked at Tel Aviv as if it were Manhattan. We looked at our world as if we were living in some bubble here, free from all the pressures of the Middle East, that somehow we had been accepted in this area of the world, and Tel Aviv was just another smaller Manhattan, a city that never sleeps. And we were awakened from that reverie by the war in Lebanon. But the problem is, as one of his co-writers in Haaretz put it, a decadent society is not prepared to deal with threats to its very existence, and many threats to its very existence. A decadent society will not rise to that challenge. This self-examination, where Ari Shavit turned towards the Israeli elite, and he said, you stopped sending your children to the army, you stopped believing that there was any, you told all of us that we were so insanely powerful that there was no need to worry about the army, there was no need to worry about our children, there was no need to ever worry and fight again. All these problems have been solved, and everyone could just concentrate on amassing the greatest fortune that they possibly could. That was available for all of us. And in the process, you destroyed all our national narrative. The Israeli, you know, people talk about the six nutcases who went to Tehran dressed in Hasidic garb. And they've drawn tremendous world attention. I spent the last 3 weeks talking to foreign press about these guys. Even 2 weeks later, I spent 2 hours with Newsweek last week and an hour with a reporter from the AP talking about the six guys who went to Tehran. And obviously, for religious Jews, they constitute about as big an embarrassment as we're ever likely to face. But in terms of their actual damage, they are a fraction of the damage of hundreds of tenured faculty members at Israeli universities, including the leaders of the worldwide academic boycott of Israeli academic institutions, who are tenured faculty members at Ben-Gurion University, at Haifa University. You have a tenured history professor at Ben-Gurion who's gone around the world singing the praises of Norman Finkelstein, who was quasi Holocaust denier. These are the ones who are teaching our children. The influence of those six guys in Tehran was absolutely negligible. They had no influence in any community beyond themselves. When they came back to Manchester, one went from Manchester was thrown out of the burial society. He's not allowed in any shul. He can't buy kosher meat any place in the city. They were totally ostracized. But in a country in which we continue to grant tenure and to those who are undermining Israeli society from within, that's a 10 times worse problem than the one that we face from those guys, from the fellows who went to Iran. The point I'm making is, and as Shavit makes it so clearly, he said, you cut off the national narrative, you cut off all sources of national will, you cut off all belief in ourselves, you brought us to the state where, you know, where you could read every day in Haaretz one author or another saying, we are people who live on another people's land, we are people who have stolen another people's land, we are those who refuse to live in peace with our neighbors, and this tremendous haranguing day after day on Israeli guilt and basically in support of the traditional Palestinian narrative coming from our own cultural sources. And that was, there was a sense that he has gone too far. This has gone too far. It can't go on any longer. And Shavit puts it, unless all our national resources are concentrated on rebuilding national will, rebuilding some sense of ourselves, giving ourselves some sense of national purpose, we cannot survive here. But that is itself, that analysis is itself a sense of hope. Not that revivifying national will is an easy project. It's not an easy project. It's not something that will be done easily. It's not some, you can't go in, have a budget item, a national budget item, national will spend $5 million on that or $5 billion. You can't order it off the shelf in the pharmacist. Give me a little bit of national will. But it is clear that that is the situation that we've reached. If we don't have some sense of ourselves, a basic sense of ourselves, we won't even stay here, much less fight for the right to stay here. Now, one of the happy aspects of Israeli society is the determination that when push has been pushed to shove, is the determination that Israelis have shown. In 2002, after the Seder bombing in Netanya, when over 100% of reservists turned up, in other words, people who hadn't even been called for reserve duty, turned up for Operation Defensive Shield. That happened again this summer in Lebanon. There were 1 million refugees from the north for whom the government did nothing this summer. And they were absorbed and brought in to the homes of, usually in most cases, virtual strangers in the center and the center of the country. In other words, we hosted in our own homes as many as in our small four-room apartment, which already has 10 souls in it. We had another family of 7 who we didn't know. We met complete strangers who stayed with us for a number of days, and that was repeated. That was a scenario repeated over and over again throughout the country. There is an indication that there is still what to be saved, that there is determination to survive. It is Israelis have not given up the battle yet, but we have to understand that in the end, we have to return to our sources, we have to return to our Masorah, we have to return to our sense of ourselves as a people, and to our sense of ourselves with a mission, and to talk openly about our mission, to talk openly about why there should be a Jewish people in the world. It's interesting that last week I had a niece here who was visiting with one of the Birthright programs, and she told me about the speech that Prime Minister Olmert had given, and over again he talked about, in that speech, instead of talking about what a fun place Israel is, and did you see the discos, and did you see this, and did you see that, as has happened in previous Birthrights, he talked only about, did you see the land of our fathers, your fathers? Did you see the biblical site? And focused his entire speech on the fact that this is your country and it is your people's country and it has been your people's country for millennia. It was significant to see this refocus. There is, what I'm suggesting is that there is now a sense that something drastic needs to be done. There is a process of self-examination in Israeli society. And that creates, and again here I speak as a religious Jew who believes that ultimately without some greater focus on religious identity, without a significant turn and refurbishing of religious identity across the entire Israeli population, that we will not have the resources to prevail here and the will to continue. But I think that presents a remarkable opportunity for us at the present time. The problem is, even here, and let's try it in on an optimistic note, and then we'll take some questions. Just some examples of some things that I've seen in recent weeks that gave me hope. They're small scale. They don't herald a major shift in the country, but they herald the beginning of a shift. Just some examples. There's one organization which I've gone around in the north with, an organization called Ayelet HaShachar, which has placed religious families on large kibbutzim, yeshuvim, some of the most anti-religious places in the country, just to see what would happen if there was an exposure to a religious couple. In Kfar Tabor, which is a settlement, a small suburban community outside of Afula, I met a woman there when she and her husband and their family settled, rented a house there about 3 years ago. They were spit at on the streets. People asked them, why have you come here? Today, there are 70 women going to the mikveh in Kfar Tabor. That's one family in the space of 3 years. There was another couple that I met which was on a kibbutz. The first time that he walked into the kibbutz store, they told him, what are you doing here? He said, I'm working doing kashrut supervision for your food plant. And they said, I don't care what you're doing here. You're never going to buy in the store. Get out. He started asking around, was there anybody who might be interested in a Shabbat service? And they said, well, the most interested person here in religion is so-and-so. Why don't you go talk to him? So he went to talk to him. Before he had opened up his mouth, the person told him, he said, I want you to know just one thing. I hate you. I hate God. And I hate your religion. Your religion. This was the most identified man on the kibbutz. His wife happened to be in New York, and she went on Yom Kippur, she fasted and went to the nearby kibbutz Levi, which is a religious kibbutz. And he repeated this pizmon, this little song, throughout their conversation. After 2 years on this kibbutz, where they now have 100 people for Yom Kippur davening, after 2 years on this kibbutz, just one family living there, they were asked to head the kibbutz cultural vad, the Vad HaTavut, the cultural Vad on the kibbutz, which is the most important. They couldn't take the job because many of the activities which the Vad sponsors are not ones which any from Jew would want to do. At the same time, however, the fact that they could have been offered this position, they had been accepted on the kibbutz, that they had a tremendous Torah celebration on the kibbutz in which almost the entire kibbutz participated. These kinds of stories, another project they have is this, like Partners in Torah Learning, an American model, where they have 2,000 women who are learning, an ongoing learning situation with women who have expressed the desire, to learn Torah with somebody from the Haredi community. Something that would be thought unthinkable. The woman who heads this project told me that 11, when she had her first child and went into Ein Kerem Hospital in Jerusalem, non-religious women in the hospital were no more interested in talking to her than they were talking to an Arab woman who had just had a baby there. By the time it came to her 11th child, she said, and especially when her children came to visit her in the hospital, everybody wanted to talk to her. There's some sense in the country where there's a loss of trust of husbands and wives, a loss of respect of children for their parents and so forth and so on, that there just might be some secret. There might be something in our tradition that's worth exploring. She tells me she believes that in Jewish women, just Jewish women alone, lies the power to affect a revolution in the country. Of course, she comes to this view in a natural fashion. She told me one story, and I think it's one of the most beautiful stories that I've heard in recent months, maybe ever. Her mother was a famous tzaddikus, a Slonim of Hasidusa, named Tora Bomo. She worked a lot with Russian immigrants to the country. She was often at the airport greeting them. She was very active in Russian Aliyah. A remarkable woman about whom a whole book has been written. When this woman was about 60 years old, she detected a small growth on her neck. She went to the doctor, and the doctor examined the growth, and he told her that it was much worse than she thought. He told her that the cancer had really spread everywhere in her body, and she didn't have long to live. And she smiled. So the doctor thought that she hadn't understood him. And he said to her, "I don't think you understood. You don't have long to live." And she continued to smile. And he said, "Why are you smiling? I just told you that you're under a death sentence." She said, "Why shouldn't I smile? I have the best parents that any child could ask for. My ninth child has just been engaged. My youngest child has just been engaged. All my children are going on the path that I set out for them. Why shouldn't I smile?" When the family was sitting Shiva, this doctor came to her house, came to the Shiva house, and said, "I just wanted to see the family that brought that smile to her face." Now, her daughter today, who had this tour of learning project, this phone project, and I managed to meet both the volunteers in the project and some of the women that they're working with. Extraordinary experience. She said, "It's not just my mother. We all have that power." I tell women, because inevitably in the course of these telephone relationships, there's a private meeting, they meet together, they come to their mentor's home, and I find the mentors go frantic. They're polishing the homes, and they're trying to whitewash the walls, and they're doing this. And I tell them, forget it, that's not what they're coming for. If they wanted to see neatly whitewashed homes, they'd stay in Herzliya Pituah. If they wanted to see haute couture, they could stay in Tel Aviv. They don't need you. They're not coming here to see fashion. They're not coming here to see beautiful homes. They're coming here to see what the secret that you have in those homes is. And when you hear a person like that talking, and you see the results, and you see how many have called in, and she has another 15,000 names of women who have expressed an interest, to some friend who has also themselves been interested, has recommended, also contact this person. You begin. This reminds me of high school debate when a card would come up and say, "Your time is up, you've gone too long." But usually my wife performs that function. She's not here right now, and I haven't trained my 12-year-old son to do that, so. And when you see that kind of power, that kind of hope, and you see a society which has recognized that we basically reached the end of the tether, a society which recognizes that the problem isn't just outside of ourselves, it's not just our politicians, it's not just the failed generals in the last war, it's not just the other guy, but it is within us, and that we have to look within ourselves, we have to look back towards our sources, then at least on that score, we can begin to see where the solution must lie. If the solution hasn't presented itself yet, we at least know where the sources of hope lie and where that ray of sunshine will come from. Thank you very much.
It's going to be our pleasure to take at least several questions. Robert Rosenblum will be able to see you and interact in real time. You can ask questions just as if this was a live presentation. I will also ask, as a moderator based on a couple of previous weeks, you please keep questions to under 45 seconds to a minute so that they are questions rather than statements of personal philosophy. Thank you.
What may be the conditions under which homelessness appears from the sea?
Right now, almost as a consequence of the weakness, not only his own political weakness, but that of Amir Peretz, the largest other bloc in the coalition, in some sense, their very weakness, as I said at the beginning, makes this one of the most stable coalitions. No current member of the coalition believes that it could depart from the coalition without dramatically reducing its electoral strength. In other words, no one in Kadima is willing to lead a charge to get rid of Olmert or to bring about new elections because they know that Kadima would go right down the tubes, and many of them only got in by happenstance into the Knesset this time. The likeliest scenario, I suppose, for his leaving the scene without new elections is probably that there would be a massive outcry for Tzipi Livni to replace him. For anybody who thinks that would be the solution to our problem, she happens to be a very nice woman, by the way. Not unintelligent, but anybody who thinks that that's the solution to our problems, read Evelyn Gordon's recent column called "She'd Only Make It Worse" in the Jerusalem Post, and find out how we would only. That is not the solution. But I think that that's the most immediate hope for at least Olmert leaving the state. Of course, the other possibility is that he will be criminally indicted over either over the Bank of Lumi sale or over the multiple transactions involving his various residences in Jerusalem, or any other another couple of investigations underfoot. So if indicted, then the Supreme Court would then he would have to resign. Yeah.
Does the Haredi have a wish list of who they would like to come forward? Haredi meaning the people that are voting in government.
I'll tell you the truth. This was really supposed to be the last part of the speech, and I'm going to talk about some of the weaknesses of the various religious factions in Israel, both National Religious and Haredi, to be the motor propelling this rediscovered national identity. One of the problems with the Haredi community is that we have not learned to think nationally to a sufficient degree. We have not learned to think beyond our own immediate interests. And many times our internal agenda has been led or forced upon us by people who know in no respect represent the community, but who do tremendous damage and lessen our ability to reach out to the general population. The rioters before the subsequently canceled gay parade in Jerusalem, those who went to Tehran is another example. We have not learned to think, and we have never trained ourselves to think, what if we were in charge here? What would we don't present a national agenda. We don't present a national wish list. We talk about that we view our role exclusively as protecting the pure core of Torah learning. Even within the Haredi world, we focus on protecting the pure core of Torah learning, rather than recognizing our responsibility to reach out. I mean, there are many in the community who recognize that responsibility. But even they tend to think in terms exclusively of Kiruv and not so much in terms of a political agenda. And partly the leaders have trained themselves not to interject themselves into the major political events of the country for a very simple reason. And I think, and very understandable, and I would even venture right, is that they never wanted to exercise the decisive vote or the decisive opinion on matters of national security so long as Haredi boys are not serving in the army. As long as they're not serving in the army in large numbers, we should not be the ones either exercising the major decisions on war and peace on either side of the balance. So I don't think there is a wish list. I wanted to respond to you with a joke, you know, forget the joke. My wife doesn't like it anyhow, so I'll skip it. And even though we share a common alma mater, we're both University of Chicago graduates, he can make great sense, he has a lot to say, but I don't believe that his bima in the Jewish press will be sufficient to bring him into the Israeli Knesset. I think the focus right now is not really on particular personalities, and one Knesset seat would be insignificant in any event. He asked me about it, Professor Paul Eidelberg, who writes in the Jewish press and is a political thinker of some note. Not the most solicitous writer in the world, perhaps, but it's certainly a very profound thinker, but I don't think we'll ever see him in the Knesset. Yeah.
You look at the destructive nature of Palestinian education, but you didn't really talk about the education system in Israel. And to my understanding, there's a real problem there as well. It seems like they're presenting a post-Zionist, non-religious viewpoint, and if you have neither Zionism from a non-religious perspective, nor Zionism from a religious perspective. Why are we in Israel?
Well, that is, I mean, I think that I thought was a major thing when I talked about the academics at the higher level. There's two problems with the Israeli educational system right now. The one is the one that you've mentioned, and to tell you the truth, it's such a big subject in and of itself. I used to devote an entire speech to talking about a book called A World of Change. If you read Yoram Kadoni's The Jewish State, he discusses a lot the textbooks in Israeli high schools, and he led the moves to prevent the use of a particular textbook which basically adopted the Palestinian narrative. It's interesting, he went around the United States debating the person who had developed it, who was the chair of the committee under which this textbook had been recommended for use in Israeli high schools. And at the end, when enough dirt came to light on the particular textbook, this person had debated Kadoni about 10 times, tried to retreat and say, well, I never actually read the book. It's interesting that he had been willing to go around the country debating Kadoni. He was no mean debater himself. He was a national debate champion at Princeton without ever having read the book, but that was the best he could come up with. That gives you an idea of how bad, in fact, the book was. But there's another problem with Israeli education, too, is that, the endemic violence in the schools, the poor performance. Israel was, in the 50s and the early 60s, was a world leader in almost every international testing of the mathematical reading comprehension. It's now ranking down in 34 out of 37 industrialized countries, with places like Romania and Bulgaria. We're producing some extremely high-level, brilliant scientists and so forth, but the base, the cultural base, is not high, and that's a real threat. We don't have enough mechanical engineers. We don't have a lot of people who keep machines going, even that level of education, to keep the machines going. We have a top level of the society which is producing a phenomenally profitable and exportable high-tech sector, but it's not the vertical educational system throughout the system is very weak, and that's another major threat that we're confronting.
We have not had some time, I think, at least, a prime minister of the type and quality of caliber of the late Menachem Begin. Looking at what is out there today, is in my mind not that Sharansky might fit the bill, although he has stepped out of politics more recently. Do you think that he might at all reconsider and potentially even look at the position of prime minister down the road? Certainly, he has a tremendous following among so many people, both religious and non-religious.
Well, certainly he would not, unfortunately. I mean, he tested his electoral appeal a couple times recently. The most enthusiastic community for Nathan Sharansky, and I think it's an enthusiasm that was well-placed, it was the Anglo-speaking religious community in Israel, which I think constituted most of his voters in the last election. Just, people like ourselves, who saw him as a figure who can reconcile some of the contradictions, some of the tensions in society, who clearly had a strong, deeply rooted in sense of himself as a Jew, as Menachem Begin was. Anybody who's read Yehuda Avner's pieces in the Jerusalem Post, describing many instances in which Begin was simply overwhelmed by his sense of himself as a Jewish boy growing up in Brisk, and how that never left him, and it was very central to his identity. That has largely been lost in Israeli society. Even his own children don't have anything. They retain his rectitude and honesty, but they don't retain that sense of themselves as part of in Jewish history that he had as a European-born Jew. I don't think Sharansky, he's always had a much bigger audience in America. As he himself says in his book that was so popular in the White House, is that these ideas never got any hearing. He couldn't even when he was a cabinet member, he couldn't get Ariel Sharon or any other Israeli prime minister to listen to him or to talk about what would be necessary to create a peace-loving and a Palestinian society that was willing to live in peace. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure being with you today. A couple weeks ago, after I had given a similar speech and answered questions and sat down to the as much tumultuous applause as 50 people can muster. Somebody stood up and suddenly said, well, can I just say one last thing? And he then spoke for the next 10 minutes saying, you know, your speech, as far as I'm concerned, was just a crock, and I have everything you said was wrong, and I blah, blah, blah. He went on for 10 minutes. So I'm prepared to leave it where we are right now. And based on this experience, I asked, even though I've been thinking for the last 2 weeks, what was the proper rejoinder after somebody's given a counter speech and just told everybody that it wasn't worth hearing, sitting here for the last hour and 10 minutes? But on the outside chance that somebody still wants to deliver that speech there, I'm going to pass.
Not a problem. You remind me of a friend of mine from Princeton who once asked a 10-minute question of a speaker, a very long-winded question, which the speaker said, yes, and moved on to the next question.
Well, in this case, so is my...
We'll keep the connection live for anybody who wants to remain. Let me just tell everybody else. I do have one comment, which is that anybody who is willing to wander around the country debating Yoram HaZoni without having read the book that they're supposed to be discussing is not merely a fact of his political views being whacked out. The guy is obviously a complete fool. Yoram HaZoni was, he and I both grew up in Princeton, New Jersey together. He spent a year in Israel. I matriculated a year early, so he was actually a year behind me in Princeton. One of those charismatic guys you'd ever meet. He was McCoverave as a barely informed Balshuva himself. He brought another 8 to 10 people along with him, just in the Princeton Jewish crowd that year, and indeed was a national debate tournament chairman alongside Dan Palasar. Both of them have been very involved with the Shalem Center, which Yoram HaZoni founded, and he ended up writing a book alongside Bibi Netanyahu, who is just an outstanding speaker and writer and everything. So the idea that somebody would willingly go head-to-head with it without knowing what they were talking about, it's simply a sign of nascent insanity. So thank you very much. The coming speakers in the weeks ahead in this series, all again at 10 a.m. on February 4th, we're going to have Robbie Daron Kornbluth speaking about interfaith.